The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Signing ceremony for the deal between the United States and Iran is just 48 hours away. And the details of this memorandum of understanding are starting to leak. Axios reports that within the agreement, there is an agreed upon ceasefire across all fronts, including Lebanon. This also would include Iran reaffirming it will never have a nuclear weapon, and nuclear activities would be frozen during the talks. The U.S. will pause new sanctions on the Iranian regime and lift the U.S. naval blockade. Iran will guarantee safe passage for vessels going through the Strait of Hormuz for the next 60 days. And the U.S., over a tiered system, will release some frozen assets and allow temporary Iranian oil exports. Now, talks aimed at a broader peace deal will take place, and some sanctions relief will be ongoing. There are reports of a $300 billion reconstruction fund for Iran, likely coming from money in Gulf countries. And the Iranians and the Omanis would work with Gulf states to negotiate new Hormuz shipping lane security frameworks.
You've seen the details in this memorandum of understanding that still remains secret, that both members, even of your party, are saying, wait, I don't know the details yet, so they're skeptical. So let me ask you this.
Yep.
Can you confirm that it is going to end all sanctions against Iran, that it will ensure reconstruction financing of at least $300 billion for Iran, and that it will release all frozen funds, which could be more than $100 billion. Given that amount of money flowing into Iran, how does that amount of money flowing into the chief exporter of terror make America safer?
So none of those things flow to Iran unless Iran fundamentally changes how it behaves with the world. If you look at the memorandum of understanding, and again, it's going to come out whether later today or on Friday, what it fundamentally says is Iran can have their economy with less sanctions on it, but only if they change the way that they interact with the world. So what the president is really saying is, if Iran fundamentally transforms how it deals with the United States and the region, the rest of the world, then Iran can get some economic benefits. But I think what you've seen is people emphasizing the benefits that the Iranians get, but for them to get those benefits, they would have to change the kind of country that they are, which would be a major win for the American people.
You understand why.
It's a very strong deal. Nobody knows what it is, but it's very strong.
The text of the agreement now final, or are you still...
No, it's not final. It's a memorandum of understanding. And if I don't like it, we'll go back to shooting at them, dropping bombs on their head.
But here is the great illusion that we have today in the Western world, and especially in America and Britain, and even in the... to a lesser degree, I think, in the Jewish nation in the Middle East, and that is that we can solve all problems through negotiation. And that is a delusion. It is a delusion. If you go ahead beyond judgment and wisdom and negotiate with people who will make no concessions at all about their vow to destroy you, well, then it becomes a wound. It's not a peace pact. It's a wound. God calls these peace pacts we're making around the nation of Judah. God is telling us that those are wounds. They're not going to bring peace. They could never bring peace. There is a time when, well, you have to realize that negotiation won't solve that problem, if you continue negotiating, then you have a great wound, whether it's America and Britain or the nation in the Middle East, the Jewish nation in the Middle East. These are deadly wounds.
Yet another foreign policy disaster when it comes to the number one state sponsor of terrorism, Iran. And this time it comes under the watch of President Trump. This foreign policy, many are even calling it worse than the JCPOA, worse than Obama. And really, it's more than a disaster or a blunder. It's a negotiated surrender on the part of the United States. We've got to tell you the truth. It is what it is. You heard my father there. That's from 2015. And even as I assembled some of the quotes from our literature over the last couple of years with respect to America's betrayal of Israel and then how this is going to play out, this war with Iran, we had it covered from beginning to end in the April issue of the Trumpet magazine. And it's spot on. We were right. We've been right. We've been right since 1992, when my father first identified Iran as the prophesied king of the South. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to the live video of this program at our website, thetrumpet.com, or at the Rumble channel or the YouTube channel. And you can also submit feedback through email, td@thetrumpet.com. So we'll go through some of the same material again, as you heard on the program yesterday with Sam Livingston subbing in. A little repetition in this case. It's needed because this is epic. This level of failure on the part of the United States. And we're just seeing it play out over and over again. Israel about to take out Hamas, finally. And in comes the United States to negotiate Israel's retreat. It happened with Hamas. It's happening now with Hezbollah. And on a much larger scale, of course, it's happening with Iran. The mullahs are celebrating. They outlasted the mighty United States. This shows how weak America is and how strong the mullahs still are. No one's denying that their navy was sunk and they were hit hard by the United States barrage, the push-button warfare. But the radicals are still in charge. And the United States says, enough. No mas. No more. No more fighting. And Israel, it applies to you too. No more fighting in Lebanon. Doesn't matter what Hezbollah does to Israeli citizens in the north. Just stop going after Hezbollah. Let them survive. Throw them a lifeline. This is some deal. And the fact that we don't even hold our cards to our chest. We just show them. We show the enemies our hand. Here's what we intend to do. It's going to be a limited warfare. We definitely aren't going to go in for the kill shot. Now, we might talk tough. There might be some strong rhetoric. Things like unconditional surrender. But in the end, what happened? Did it in any... It's been leaked to all these press outlets. The U.S. does this, 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 and this, and then you get to Iran, and Iran just has to play nice. Iran just has to say, as they've said for decades, we're not going to build a nuclear weapon. No, no. So we got them to reiterate that. That's actually in the 12-point plan, the memorandum of understanding. Yeah, we got them to reiterate that they're not going to build a nuclear weapon. Doesn't that make you feel very secure and safe? Listen, I think Sam Livingston played this yesterday. President Trump just talking about how much he really appreciates the Iranian leadership and he can trust them. Clip one.
I mentioned Iran. We appreciate the relationship we've had over the short period of time with Iran. The primary thing, it's, you know, we can talk about the Iran deal all day long, but we're not investing any money. We have the right to if we want, but we're not investing any money. We didn't pay for it like Obama did. He paid billions of dollars. He paid $1.7 billion from an airplane, all green cash. It was crazy. I watched that. I couldn't believe it. But the one thing that's happening that's of note, frankly, the only thing that really matters to me, is Iran will never have a nuclear weapon. And it says it loud and clear. Now, you talk about regime change. I never cared about regime change. It's never a part, but I guess you have regime change because you know better than anybody. The first group, they're all dead. The second group, they're dead. A part of the third group is gone. And we're dealing with people that I think are very rational people. And they were nice to deal with. They were strong people, smart people. I think actually they're smarter than the first and second group. But they're not radicalized, and they're, you know, looking to help their country.
They're not radicalized. These are jaw-dropping statements. They're not radicalized. They're rational. They're nice to deal with. Bibi, not so much. But the mullahs, the third string, yeah, they're really nice to deal with. They're strong people. I like working with them. They're smart. This is delusional. If he was not the president, and just put Obama in that chair, what do you suppose President Trump would say? What do you suppose, you know, the real estate tycoon Donald Trump would say if Obama, if the roles were reversed, if Obama was sitting there saying, yeah, Iran, there's some pretty good people. They're very rational. I like dealing with them. They're not radicals at all. It's really unbelievable. These points that were leaked from the MOU, I guess they're calling it, the Memorandum of Understanding. Number one, immediate and permanent end to the war on all fronts, including Lebanon. Somehow Lebanon gets reeled into this. That's Iran's proxy. And their objective is to kill Jews. So they survive under this memorandum of understanding. Another one, Iran and the U.S. will negotiate and reach a final agreement within a maximum period of 60 days. So it's not even a peace agreement. It's just a memorandum of understanding. And the hostilities stop. The sanctions are lifted. A lot of commentators are saying that happens now. So it may not be pallets of cash on a tarmac somewhere, but it's plenty of cash, believe me. We're talking about hundreds of billions. The U.S. will lift the naval blockade. Here again, the U.S. The U.S. has to lift the blockade. The U.S. with its regional partners will create a comprehensive plan for the rehabilitation and economic development of Iran, ensuring financing of at least $300 billion. So here we go in. And again, this is just war. This is the way it happens in war. All the big talk. We obliterated the nuclear weapons program. We destroyed that. We absolutely won this war. And now here we are a few months later. Desperate to get out of it, and then $300 billion. Sorry we blew everything up, but here's a third of $1 trillion so that you can rebuild. Yeah, it comes to you courtesy of Uncle Sam. Even if the main contributors are in the Middle East, still, this is the United States negotiating the end of this war. It's a total capitulation, a total surrender. Stunning. Stunning to watch. Iran will immediately take steps to ensure that movement of merchant ships from the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and vice versa is resumed within 30 days. Frozen or restricted funds and assets of Iran will be released and made fully available. Another point on the agreement. The United States commits to ending all types of sanctions currently facing Iran. All sanctions lifted. I haven't seen the actual document. This is all according to leaked sources. So we'll see. Maybe there's a few things in here that aren't quite right. But it's all over the news. The New York Post, Axios, everybody. Fox News, you heard it there in the cold open. The worst foreign policy blunder in American history. That's what my father said in 2016. After Obama, basically, came out and said, they're pretty good people. I like working with them. They're rational. They're not radical. Just made a good deal. The dear leader made a deal with the devil. And here we are 10 years later. And it's the same. It's worse, in fact, because, like Melanie Phillips says, we're snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory. We were so close, just like Israel was with taking out Hamas. That close. And then here come the negotiators. And my father warned of this 11 years ago. You heard it in the cold open. This is some guy's tweet, having read all that's been leaked. Unfreezing Iranian funds. Here's what we're conceding. $300 billion reconstruction. Hezbollah is untouchable. Iran can execute protesters at will. Iran retains control over the Strait of Hormuz. Lifting of sanctions. Ballistic missile program will not be restrained. Funding of terrorist proxies will not be restricted. And what Iran is conceding? Well, they promise to be nice. They promise that they're not really intent on building a nuclear weapon. It's not really that important to them. There's no real commitments that Iran is making. It's not even, as I say, it's not even a deal. It's a memorandum. It's a memorandum where Iran reiterates that they're actually a peaceful administration. They're actually a peaceful religion. Listen to J.D. Vance with Megyn Kelly, clip 13.
Now, if they comply with this deal, I think it's much better for the United States and it's going to be much better for Iran. But if they don't comply with the deal, the straits are still open. We've still done incredible damage to their nuclear program. And it's really, you know, we can get on with our lives as a country. And they don't get anything if they don't
turn off
anything.
The financial spigot.
If they don't comply, well, we've already done some good things there, and we can move on. We can move on. We can dust our hands of this case. You can see the desperation. And it's going to be framed. It's going to be framed in ways that say America obtained an overwhelming victory here. But that's not what happened. That's not what is happening. Listen again to Vice President Vance, clip 7.
It is kind of ironic that they're really, really worried about stopping this thing, but they were completely gung-ho about starting this thing. And look, I want to be responsive and charitable to some of these concerns. So first of all, why do they believe Iranian propaganda only about one thing, the peace deal? They don't seem to believe Iranian propaganda, rightfully so, about anything else. So if you're in the position of endorsing Iranian propaganda only when it's related to this peace deal, then maybe you should check yourself a little bit and question your sources. The second thing that I'd say is, what is their alternative? Fundamentally, if you look at what they're proposing an endless conflict. They want this to go on until every bomb has been dropped or until every Iranian is dead. That is not what the President of the United States wants.
He's answering critics there. Those that want the bombs to continue dropping. Those who just want unconditional surrender. Something President Trump early on said he wanted. Now it's the United States desperately trying to get out of it. Oil's too high. We got the midterms coming up in a few months. Melanie Phillips, in her piece, Cyrus No More, she says, contrary to much misreporting, the MOU is not a deal that ends the war. It's rather a framework for negotiations during a 60-day ceasefire. Well, look at the last ceasefire in April. It's going to be interesting to see how the 60 days plays out, because Iran has proven to be so brazen in its attacks on Jews, on American targets. Even when its military has supposedly been obliterated, they're still sending out drones and so on. It says, in a blizzard of claims and counterclaims, we don't know what its terms are. But what's undeniable is that Trump has chosen this moment, when the Iranian regime was weakening by the day, to take his knee off the windpipe by lifting the U.S. blockade of Iranian ships. Going into the 60-day negotiation, he has thus chosen to make Iran stronger and the U.S. weaker. Make Iran great again. Make the United States, certainly its position, much weaker. She says, the U.S. originally said Iran must not enrich uranium, period, yet Trump has told the New York Times that Iran would be permitted to enrich uranium at a low level and never for military purposes. But how low? It's possible to get quite easily from some relatively low levels to weapons-grade enrichment in a short space of time. But listen, they've reiterated that that's not their intent. They said they're going to be nice. You lift all the sanctions and we're going to play nice. You can trust us. Trump has said repeatedly that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon, and if it tried to, would suffer unbelievable consequences. But he's also said, we're talking to them about a 15 to 20 year ban. Well, which is it? This sounds exactly like the 2015 Obama deal. Yeah, there was a sunset clause in that. You can get it as long as you wait it out. As long as you're patient, you can get your nuke. But it'll just come a long time after I'm finished being president. And I don't have to worry about it then. So close to total victory. And yet, what does the Bible say about America in these last days? Look at the blessings and cursings chapters. It's as if every day headlines are screaming that we're moving into the times of the Gentiles. And our nations, the nations of Israel, the U.S., Britain, you've got this report in Britain, all these rape gangs that have gone on for years and years, and estimates that some 250,000 girls, British girls, mostly white, raped by mostly Muslim men. Older men, middle-aged, old men. That's going on at home, here in our own countries. And then you look at what's happening abroad. The worst foreign policy blunder in American history. That's what my father said about the JCPOA 10 years ago. Well, here's another one. Giving Obama a run for his money. Who would have thought? Melanie Phillips says, Vance says the big difference from the Obama deal is that Iran will be required to verify its commitment not to build a nuclear weapon. But the Obama deal also required verification. Tehran merely hid what it was doing in sites unknown to the nuclear inspectors or from which they were barred. Iran says, sure, you can come on in and inspect everything. Well, except over there. Now, that's to remain secret. It's so easy for the United States and Britain to just be duped and to be led along like a dumb animal, nodding in agreement. Okay, we finally have gotten them to reiterate. Fantastic. We can finally understand each other. We've got the reiteration. The United States denied Israel's request to view the newly agreed Memorandum of Understanding before the signing ceremony. Israel, you know, for its part, would kind of like to know the terms of the agreement, but no, 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 absolutely not. It's private. It's just between me, Donald Trump, and the logical, rational, non-radicalized mullahs of Iran. No insight for you, little Israel. No, not at all. And you look at the way at the G7, the way President Trump talks about any other leader all across the Middle East, even the Syrian guy, the jihadist in a suit. He's wonderful. Bibi can't be trusted. Bibi, you have to unleash a profanity-laced tirade against Bibi every once in a while, like every week almost, as if Bibi's the problem. Listen to this from President Trump yesterday, clip 4.
So, I'm not happy with the way Israel has handled themselves with Lebanon and with Hezbollah. They should have been able to do the job faster. It just goes on forever. And when that happens, it throws a negative light on the big deal, and that's the deal with Iran. So, when you ask me about Bibi, an unbelievable relationship. But Israel would have been blown up a long time ago had I not gotten involved.
It's really hard to watch. Just the level of hubris, pride, and arrogance. And then, more and more, and he's seeing it in the polls, the Jew hatred, the fact that that's spreading, even in America. I don't like the way Israel's handled this battle with Hezbollah. It throws negative light on the big deal. The big deal is the memorandum with Iran. That's the big deal. We're putting everything in the big deal. And so Israel needs to dial it back. We can't, under any circumstances, put the big deal in danger of ever happening. So Israel has to be handcuffed. Here's another one. This is the bilateral meeting that he had with the Emir of Qatar, clip 2.
Mr. President, what are the expectations for Israel? Can this deal survive if Israel attacks Lebanon?
It can, and, you know, I consider that the minor war, the Iran's a big one, but we have that a little pinprick out there that constantly rears its head, and that's Hezbollah. And, you know, I was very responsible for Syria, and the man that's running Syria now is a person that I put there along with President Erdogan and some others. He's done an amazing job of pulling it together. He's not a Boy Scout. But he's done an amazing job of pulling it together. And he is very good with Hezbollah, does not like them. And I'll tell you what, Israel's fighting Hezbollah too long, and too many people are being killed. And you don't have to knock down an apartment house every time you're looking for somebody, because there are a lot of people in those apartment houses, and they're not all Hezbollah, that I can tell you. And I suggested to Israel to let Syria take care of Hezbollah. Because to be honest with you, I think they'd do a better job of doing it.
Wow. The jihadist. The Al-Qaeda guy. Let him take care of it. To be honest, I think they'd do better than Israel. Because, you know, he really hates him some Hezbollah. Israel's fighting Hezbollah too long, and too many people are being killed because they use human shields, because they put their missiles in apartment complexes. That's how they get the international press to gang up on Israel. Oh, look at the apartment building that went down. It's Israel that's the problem. You see it in that statement from President Trump. He is surrounded by a lot of Jew hatred. Pure and simple. Listen to Fox News as he talks about, or they talk about, Donald Trump or President Trump tearing into Bibi, clip 15.
I just spoke with President Trump. I asked him about the Israeli strikes earlier today against Hezbollah in the Lebanese capital of Beirut. He tells me he spoke on the phone with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, asking him, "What the F are you doing?" He told the Prime Minister not to conduct additional strikes against Hezbollah so that it doesn't affect this deal from moving forward.
At the same time, Trey, I think it's fair to point out that if you're the Israeli government, you have every right to defend your citizens who have been under constant attack by way of Hezbollah.
That's from Fox News. Again, more profanity. That's reserved for Bibi. This is another example of President Trump just raving over, I think in this case, Egypt's president. Qatar, Syria, Egypt, Iran even. Look at the way President Trump talks about the leaders of those countries. And then look at how he's treating or mistreating Benjamin Netanyahu, clip 6.
But I just want to say that the relationship has been outstanding. He's a man of great respect. Everybody respects him and they respect your country. And it's an honor to be with you. And we just signed a deal with Iran. And this country was very, very, a very powerful ally. And good things are happening.
And without your support, your commitment, Mr. President, not my country only, but the Middle East will be in a different part, different situation today. So really my pleasure to see you today, Mr. President. And thank you for giving us the time, and there is a lot of things we can talk about for going forward between our two countries, how we can make our relationship even better.
We love it. Thank you, my friend.
Yet another great relationship, the one with Egypt. That's thriving. Syria, I put the guy in charge in Syria. He'll do the job. He'll do it better than Israel. Qatar, and even the mullahs. They're rational. I love them. What would Donald Trump be saying right now? What would the real estate man, Donald Trump, be saying right now if Obama was bending over backwards with all of these Middle Eastern leaders? Everyone except for Bibi Netanyahu, because that's what he did. Obama hated Netanyahu. Shocking to see this coming from a Jeroboam type. Here's Sky News Australia talking about Donald Trump's recent attacks against Bibi and just the strain that's there in that relationship at the moment. Clip 11.
I think if you look at all the polling evidence in the United States, particularly among younger Democrats and younger Republicans, there has been a sea change of opinion against Israel. I think Trump probably recognises that. But he's more importantly worried about the Iran war. He wants to shut it down. And this week he has shown he will go to great lengths to shut it down, and he doesn't want anyone to get in the way.
But that's the point here, isn't it? Because the aims that he outlined about getting rid of the nuclear capacity, about making sure Iran could no longer run its proxies through Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, and also getting rid of the regime.
And the ballistic missiles.
Yeah, well, he hasn't achieved any of those. Mm. And he is caving into political pressure rather than the reality of the security interests. Yeah, but doesn't this leave us in an even worse position? Because Iran will be emboldened, the Islamist extremist mullahs who run the joint will be locked in power, and there's the potential for the nuclear weapons program to be revived.
Conceivably.
Conceivably. Melanie Phillips says, so Israel now faces an excruciating choice between abandoning its northern citizens to Hezbollah attacks and risking a vindictive Trump cutting off the military support necessary to keep itself. Where's page 6? To keep itself alive. It says, as for those Israelis who allowed themselves to put their trust in this most capricious of princes, they forgot the basic lesson of their history, that the Jews are always alone. So the Jews are left to go it alone. You can see all of these prophecies aligning the fact that the Jews eventually are going to turn to Germany for help, for assistance, for protection. And that's going to be a tragic mistake when that happens. But the U.S. clearly is on the way out. It's washing its hands of the region. Melanie says, Israeli TV's Channel 14 reported a claim that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard that runs Iran had no intention of honoring the statement. It says, IRGC commander was quoted as saying, let's take all the money right now, and then we'll do whatever we want. Let's just get the money. Let's just get the hundreds of billions. Some say that the sanctions relief, if that happens Friday, it could be as much as $100 billion. And then you've got all the loans so that they can rebuild the country, come back stronger than ever. Let's just get the money, says the IRGC, and then we could do whatever we want. And you've got J.D. Vance for his part saying, listen, even if they don't comply, we hit them pretty hard and we can move on as a country. That is the language of a loser. We have surrendered. It says here at the G7 summit, Trump said the Iranian regime had changed because so many former leaders had been killed. The people in charge now are very rational. You heard the clip. But the Iranians charming the apparently witless U.S. team are obviously telling the Americans what they want to hear, such as, according to Trump, that they now realize their four decades of waging war on the free world had been a mistake. How can any sentient being believe such patent nonsense? Iran is still being run by the IRGC, who are no less fanatical than the regime has ever been, maybe even more so. They're run by fanatics. That's the truth. And to pretend otherwise is delusional and dangerous and weak. America's lost the pride that it once had in its power. You look at this latest Trumpet magazine. You know, what is it that made us great? What is it? It says here, how America became great. And it takes you through some important history. 250 years. And you can go back much farther than that to the great patriarch Abraham in Genesis 12 and get an understanding, if you're willing to dig into the United States and Britain in prophecy, to get an understanding of why, of how America became great, why we became the recipients of so much fabulous wealth and prosperity and power and strength. And why that strength, why that power is being spent in vain. What better example is there of what we've seen these last few months and even last summer with the 12-day operation to take out the nuclear program? We were told then it was obliterated. And then earlier this year, a full-scale war breaks out. The United States working together with little Israel, brothers, allies, alliances. And look at how quickly things change. And dramatically so. The Daily Mail says, Tehran celebrates victory over America ahead of deal agreement on Friday. According to regime insiders, the Islamic Republic believes the conflict has ultimately made them stronger, with Tehran emerging intact after the U.S. failed to bring about the regime change that many adversaries hoped for. So the regime change didn't happen. They're still led by radical Islamists. Some would say even a harder line than the predecessors. And so we just put a fancy label on it that sounds good. They're rational. I really enjoy working with them. I wonder how many curse words President Trump uses when he talks to the Iranian negotiators, or the Syrian leadership, or Qatar, or Egypt. Those are reserved for America's brother nation, little Judah, in the Middle East. How America became great. You can go to our website right now to delve more deeply into that subject. And speaking of becoming great, we've got a segment that we're going to finish off with after we take a quick break that we recorded in Eugene, Oregon a couple weeks ago. It was on the subject of prayer and the history that Mr. Armstrong had with the prayer rock behind the Fisher home right there on the Fisher farm in Eugene. So we'll take a quick break and then come back and conclude with that, I think it's 12 or 13 minute segment. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
In 1994, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury asked, "Is Iraq about to fall to Iran?" It was a bold statement at the time, but over the next 20 years, this forecast became reality. Today, Iran is the undisputed king in the Middle East. In the early 1990s, we identified Iran as the prophesied king of the south. In the book of Daniel, it says this king of the south will push against the king of the north. These prophecies are being fulfilled before our eyes. To learn more about these incredible prophecies, request your free copy of The King of the South. This booklet examines the history and current events of the Middle East under the light of Bible prophecy. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
So Mr. Armstrong drank, as he said, he drank in much energy, spiritual strength, and inspiration at that prayer rock that used to reside just over the tree line on the hill behind me before we secured it back in 2002. And if you'd like to see it, if you ever come and visit Armstrong Auditorium, you can see the prayer rock inside of the auditorium in Edmond, Oklahoma. But to go back to Mr. Armstrong and his example, his incredible example, the autobiography mentions the word prayer something like 200 times. I mean, it's a major thread of his life story. Mr. Armstrong was a man of God. He was a man of prayer. He was a man in constant contact with God. And there's so many examples from the autobiography and in other writings of his that you can only cover a few in a short program or segment like this. But another one that comes to mind is that dual challenge that he got even before the church era, the Philadelphia era, started in 1933. Mr. Armstrong had his mind open to the truth of God in 1926, was converted and baptized in 1927. And it was during that dual challenge, I won't take time to get into the detail of that, but that was when he got to know the truth and when he was crying out to God in prayer and when, you know, he had to swallow a bitter pill in one sense because he had to repent of living in a way that was in opposition to God's law. And that made it like a bitter pill, as he explained. But it also opened the way to this glorious relationship that he had with his Heavenly Father. And that relationship, I mean, you carry that out in a two-way conversation like you would with a relationship with another person, only it's through Bible study and prayer, primarily at least. There are other spiritual tools that God gives to us, but Bible study and prayer, that's the two-way conversation. Here's how Mr. Armstrong wrote about this. His early years in being a converted member of God's church, he says, "I began to see everything in a new and different light. Why should it have been a difficult and painful experience to surrender to my Maker and my God?" So he's talking about his repentance early on when he was converted to the truth. He says here, "Now I came to a new outlook on life. Somehow I began to realize a new fellowship and friendship had come into my life. I began to be conscious of a contact and fellowship with Christ and with God the Father. And then he says this, when I read and studied the Bible, God was talking to me. God was talking to me, and now I love to listen. I began to pray, and I knew that in prayer, I was talking with God. I was not yet very well acquainted with God, but one gets to be better acquainted with another by constant contact and continuous conversation. So here was a case early on where he wasn't very well acquainted with God yet, but he was off to a good start. It was a mustard seed beginning, if you just look at the history. But it grew and grew and grew, just as his prayer life, his conversation with God grew over the years as well. Continuous contact with God. And you can fast forward 50-some years and see what the work was like at the end of his ministry. It really is an incredible story that's related in his autobiography, also Raising the Ruins. We've produced that many years ago. There's lots of literature that we could equip you with if you'd like to study this further. I want to take you back, though, to the New Throne of David book, where my father says, Mr. Armstrong's life is one of the highlights in the history of man. It really and truly is one of the highlights in the history of man. I mean, when you go through this area, it's a beautiful area, but as we've been filming, people have been asking, what are you here filming? And we just talk about history and all that. It goes back to Mr. Armstrong in this area. Really and truly, there should be museums here. Instead, it's just, well, a lot of the places that he met with in those early Bible campaigns, they're either gone or there's only part of it left. There's not much that you can see physically, but this was where it all started. This was where the mustard seed was planted back in 1933, or before that, going back to his conversion. It wasn't just in Eugene, Oregon, but in Salem, in Portland, and so on. That's where the work started. But my father refers to that, saying that his life, Mr. Armstrong's life, is one of the highlights in the history of man. It's a great statement. He went on to say, God really was moved by how he delivered his message. He was moved by how he used the prayer rock to keep himself fervent and stirred to do God's will. It says, so now Mr. Armstrong is going to be honored forever through the prayer rock. And this is why we went to great lengths to get the rock and to move it to Edmond, Oklahoma. And it's now in Armstrong Auditorium, as I say. But Mr. Armstrong had such a powerful prayer life. And as I say, there are a number of examples besides Christ, besides Mr. Armstrong. They're all through the Bible. But anytime you have this kind of a relationship with God, good things are going to happen. Now, the Bible also talks about forsaking the ways of this world and denying yourself and picking up the cross and following in Christ's steps. So it's not like it's easy. It's not even easy, really, to have an energetic prayer life. You have to work at it. You have to pour your heart into it. You have to go after it every day, just like Jesus did, getting up a great while before the day even started to make sure he was working on that most important relationship. There's another example in the autobiography that talks about how instrumental or important prayer was in the success of this endeavor. In this case, it was a Bible lecture campaign in Harrisburg, which I think is 20 or 30 miles north of here. But they had this Bible campaign there. And Mr. Armstrong, I think, was working with Sardis members at the time. And so there was a lot of differing opinions and so on, even squabbling, I think, within the congregation. And this is what he relates in the autobiography. It says, more and more, I was being drawn into the ministry by some power greater than I. Inexperienced though I still was in the gospel area, I had come to realize that the success of any campaign depended more on the amount and earnestness of prayer behind such a campaign than on the oratory or eloquence of the speaker. And that's when he had those campaigns together with the Sardis minister. A lot of times, you know, they thought it was more the eloquence and the oratory. And he was learning in those early years. He was learning that it depended on the relationship with God. It depended upon prayer, the prayer behind the campaign. He says, one thing I knew, if God was in it, if I were merely an instrument and God was really conducting the campaign, it was bound to bear fruit. So many valuable lessons here. I mean, if God is not in it, it's not going to produce fruit. And so he had this interesting comparison that he did learn from. Well, let's see, when I do it with those that really don't have their heart in the work, it doesn't produce fruit. And yet when I'm doing it and my heart is in it and the heart of the brethren is in it, then it produces. It really does produce. Further on, it says here, well, this is where he challenged the brethren at Harrisburg and said, okay, if we're going to have this campaign and if you want me to do it, fine, but we're all going to pray. We're going to pray 1 hour per day, if you can believe it. This is what he said. If every one of you here at this meeting will pledge yourselves right now to devote not less than 1 hour every day to earnest and believing and prevailing prayer for the success of these meetings, for God to help me and to speak through me, for God to cause the ones he is calling and drawing to attend, and for God to convict the ones he is calling, and if you will solemnly pledge to keep up this hour or more a day of prayer, beginning now until the last night of the meetings, then I'll undertake this campaign. I'll go ahead and do it. And so they agreed, and I'll just have to kind of cut the story short, but they agreed to do it, and the campaign was successful, and also they started to get along with each other a lot better. Imagine that. Here's the conclusion that I'll read from that story. We did not have droves of hundreds or thousands hitting the sawdust trail, but God did give us 4 who were converted in the meetings. So small beginnings, just 4 converts. However, we knew that the greatest good done was the spiritual revival that took place in the church brethren as a result of that hour a day spent in solid prayer. They were a changed people. They were happy. They were closer to God. And this was evidenced by their manner, their conversation, their lives. Effectual, fervent prayer changes you for the better. It helps God's work. It helps everything. It brings God into your life. It ensures that you're going to be blessed, that you're going to be happier. These are examples that God wants us to follow. I mentioned Jesus getting away a great while before day. That's in Mark 1 and verse 35. And the interesting thing about that passage is the night before, there were throngs of people at Peter's house that wanted to talk with Jesus Christ, that wanted their relatives to be healed or anointed. He was busy deep into the night on a Saturday night. And then the next morning, he got up a great while before day, probably 4, 5 a.m. in the morning. And he was off praying to God, receiving additional strength and energy and power from God. That's why Jesus Christ was able to do what he did. And it's the same with Mr. Armstrong's example. Jeremiah 25 and verse 3 talks about getting up early to carry out God's work, to carry out God's will. There's just one last example that I can leave you with, and that relates to this area of the world that we're in at the moment. Eugene, Oregon is where the World Tomorrow program started back in 1933. And the official beginning to the World Tomorrow program was in January of 1934, when Mr. Armstrong started broadcasting every week for 30 minutes on KORE in Eugene, which is just about 5-6 miles behind me. But before that, about 3-4 months before that, there was an opening for any preacher to just take a time. I think it was at 7:45 a.m. on a Sunday morning. And the radio station said, you know, it's available, it's open for anyone who wants it, if, you know, first come, first serve. And nobody wanted it because it was too early, as Mr. Armstrong said. Mr. Armstrong thought, well, 7:45, if it's free, I'll happily jump at it. This was his first experience in broadcasting. And as soon as he got into it, this man of prayer, it was blessed immediately. And the station manager couldn't believe how much response there was. That's why they then approached Mr. Armstrong about an official program. He took them up on that. 1934, as I say, the plain truth started at the Fisher Farm, by the way. The old mimeograph that he used to copy the first issue of the plain truth, that was in the Fisher Farmhouse just over the hill behind me.